I received a letter from the Harvard Business Review, dated December 30th, 1997. But lest you be overimpressed, I should explain that the stamp on the outside of the envelope costs 6.9 cents, which is sort of a giveaway that it wasn't a first-class personal letter. Here's what the letter said. Dear Mr. Anderson, your career isn't about money, is it? I didn't think so. It's about something deeper. Something so central to your core, to what makes you tick, that you can't imagine living without it. It's about... Now, do you agree with the central premise of this letter? Do you agree that your life and your career are not about money, but are about something deeper? Something that is at the central core of who you are? Something that you can't live life without? Then how would you complete this sentence? My life is about... For many, it's about making a difference. Making a difference at the end of the day or the end of the year. Certainly having made a difference at the end of a lifetime. But the question is how? The answer could be to become famous, to become rich, to become powerful, to be very good-looking, to have all of the best and most significant of relationships. But it's interesting that Jesus seemed to have an upside-down, inside-out, some would say backwards view to what is really important and what really makes a difference in life. He said, the last will be first, and the first will be last. Another time he said, whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. In one of his more controversial statements, Jesus taught, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. And in Acts 20:35, Jesus said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. It all seems rather turned around. But it is that last statement that especially interests me this morning. It is interesting because, well, it seems so contrary to what many with common sense would say. Wouldn't a lot of people say the good deal in life is to get stuff, to be surprised by a big check or some kind of a bonus or some wonderful gift? But Jesus says it's just the opposite. The happier thing, the more blessed thing, is to give it away. And if there is any doubt what he's talking about, you read the lines preceding Acts 20:35, and it's spelled out as referring to silver, gold, clothes, and things like that. It's referring to money and to material possessions, and that it's better to give them away than to get them. Now, if Jesus is right, then there are tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people who are terribly mistaken because they've deprived themselves of all kinds of happiness in life because they do not give. But on the other hand, if Jesus is wrong, there are tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people who have deprived themselves of happiness because they've given so much away that they could have kept for themselves, and they've been a lot happier for doing it. So I guess we have to decide what we think of Jesus and his statement each for ourselves. There are a couple of things that Jesus talked a lot about that are woven together in this single line. He talked a lot about money. It was one of his most frequent topics. If you were to go through the biographies of Jesus and mark every reference to money, you may be amazed at how often the topic came up. And he often talked about being happy. Actually, the New Testament word is blessed. Blessed actually refers to not just a superficial, I'm okay today happiness, but something that's deep down and profound, more of an inside baseline joy. He brings these two concepts together, money and happiness, when he says that it is more blessed to give than to receive. Now, to understand that, we can make a list of the differences that giving can make. But I'd like to reinforce that list with some quotes from 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. Take a look at it. It's on pages 1801 through 1803 in the Blue Pew Bible. The first difference that Christians make when we give is that we bless God. 2 Corinthians 8:9 is actually one of my favorite lines from the entire New Testament. It's speaking about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, saying that though he was rich, for your sakes he became poor, so that you through his poverty might be rich. And that delighted God the Father. Delights the Father. In fact, God the Father actually spoke out loud for other people to hear, saying, "This Jesus is my beloved Son, and I am pleased with him." Pleased with the way Jesus gave up all of the wealth and prestige and power of heaven, left it behind in order to generously share with all of us, including the sharing of his life when he died on the cross. That delights and blesses God the Father. This past week, I was with Charlene in Southern California, and we visited our son Brian, and we were there when he was moving into a new apartment, so we helped him. It was part of one day and part of the next. And one of the things that needed to be moved was a refrigerator. And since the refrigerator wouldn't fit in the trunk of the Chevy Cavalier that I had rented, it was necessary to get a pickup truck. So Brian borrowed a pickup truck from a friend who was right nearby. We got the truck, we went to get the refrigerator, we loaded it in the back of the truck, tied it on, and drove really only a comparatively short distance to his new apartment, unloaded it with a borrowed refrigerator cart, and then we needed to return the truck. Total miles driven were only a few. I doubt that we used a quart of gas in the entire journey, and we were running late. We had a commitment in Northern California, and it was a long drive, and we were past what should have been our departure time. But we agreed that he would drive the truck back to his friend's house. We would then go there, pick him up, and take him back to his apartment. But he insisted, even knowing that time was short, in making a stop along the way. He stopped at a service station where he bought gas for this truck. And I sat there in my rental car and thought about this and watched him. And I was pleased. I was proud. For I knew that the owner of the truck couldn't tell from the gauge whether any gas had been used at all. I knew that Brian is short on money and that it was a sacrifice to buy the gas. I knew that what he was doing was giving. He was blessing someone else. But he was blessing me. For as a father, I sat there and looked at what he was about, and I was proud of him. Proud of my son. I thought to myself, he's doing just like Jesus. This is the kind of thing that Jesus would do. And so that day he made his father happy. As we do when we give, we bless God. It delights God when we are like Jesus. It delights him when, out of limited resources, we are generous to others. He is pleased when we are thoughtful and not just centered upon ourselves. We make our father happy. But that's not all the difference that we make. The second difference that Christians make when we give is that we bless those who receive, the recipients of this giving. We make them happy because their needs are met and their lives are turned to be good. In 2 Corinthians, St. Paul is writing to explain a whole situation where the Christians in Jerusalem were in a time of economic depression. They couldn't get jobs, they were having trouble with housing, and they really didn't even have enough money to buy food. So St. Paul became a fundraiser who went north to Macedonia, in modern news frequently, north of Greece, and to Corinth, to the south, and he asked the Christians there in those churches, some of whom themselves were exceptionally poor, to generously give to provide for the Christians that were in Jerusalem. They took all the money, they put it together, and then asked Titus and a few others to transport the money from Greece all the way over to Palestine and Jerusalem. It's very interesting that it wasn't Titus alone, that it was a group of them, showing that the early church was concerned about accountability, was concerned about correct responsibility when it came to the money that was put in their charge. That is the background, then, for the statements that are made in 2 Corinthians 9, verses 12 to 14. He says that this service that you perform, this giving this money, is not only supplying the needs of God's people, although certainly it's doing that, but is also overflowing in many expressions of thanks to God. Because of the service by which you have proved yourselves, men will praise God for the obedience that accompanies your confession of the gospel of Christ and for your generosity in sharing with them and with everyone else. And in their prayers for you, their hearts will go out to you because of the surpassing grace God has given you. All of which is to say that those who received the money, the benefits, the recipients, they were pleased. Of course they were. They were happy. Now they could eat. Before they were hungry. But they had apparently prayed to God that God would supply their needs, and it was just overflowing with gratitude to God and to these people who were so generous. They were happy. And you know, there's an indescribable joy that comes from making others happy, giving them what they need. But you don't need to go back 2,000 years, and you don't need to travel all the way to the far side of Europe to experience this. It can be experienced right here. Listen Sunday after Sunday to the faith stories of the people of Wooddale Church. See what God is doing in their lives and say to yourself, it is because of my generosity that those stories are being told and those stories are being heard. Or today or some other Sunday, walk through the children's area of the church, down the hallway, and just peek through the windows and see there hundreds of young children who are learning about God and the truth of Jesus Christ under the care of godly Christian teachers in a safe environment. Or go farther down the hallway and check out what is happening with teenagers, where youth are being introduced to Jesus Christ, where they're making friends who share Christian values, where they have the enormous benefit of Christian adults who really love them and counsel them and befriend them and help them through some of the struggles of adolescence. Or do as I often do, just look around during worship on Sunday morning and watch as there are people who become enraptured with the worship of God. They don't even know where they are. They don't care about who's up front or what kind of music it is or what the architecture of the building is. They are caught up in the worship of God himself. And you think, that's happening as a result of my giving. Or if you have the ability or the interest, you could travel to distant places. You could go to the Sahel of sub-Sahara Africa and visit villages where, because of your generosity, once people were dying of hunger and thirst, but today there is a well and a garden and a church. Or to Indonesia, every day now in the news, economically racked with all of the problems that are sweeping across Asia and hitting Indonesia especially hard, but recognize that because of your generosity, there are jobs that are being provided for people, and the gospel there is being taught. Or travel to Romania, a country that has been unshackled from communism and now maybe one of the most responsive to the gospel of Jesus Christ of any country in the world. And it is because of your generosity that literally hundreds of churches are being established and thousands of people are coming to new faith in Jesus Christ. Or if that's too far, then visit personally some of the more difficult neighborhoods of Minneapolis and see the difference that your generosity is making in the lives of individuals and families and churches. Look at it and see it, that giving makes a difference, an enormous difference, and that you and I are the agents of God. We're like angels that God has sent to bless those who receive the benefits of our giving. I'll tell you, there is a satisfaction that transcends words in being able to significantly and powerfully bless others. But there's more. There's a third difference that Christians make when we give, and that is that we bless one another. And I think this is a blessing maybe that we do not as easily understand, but is so very important. It's described in 2 Corinthians 8, verses 13 to 15, like this. Our desire is not that others might be relieved while you are hard-pressed, but that there might be equality. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, their plenty will supply what you need. Then there will be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little. Now, here's how this blessing works. Those who don't have much don't give much. Makes sense. Those who have a lot, they give a lot. That makes sense. And it's all pooled together, like a family. And there's a mutual blessing that kind of ricochets around all Christians. That is, that those who can give a lot bless those who can't give very much at all by increasing, leveraging the amount of their gifts. And those who can't give very much at all, they bless those who can give a lot by being partners with them and also having an equal or a greater sacrifice. It's a blessing that goes round and round and round and round, and it's called the church. Now, that's the biblical way, and it's a blessed way. But there is also an unblessed, an unbiblical opposite. And that is when those who don't have very much say, well, you know, there's no point in me giving very much. I mean, I look and think, I hardly have enough money. And if I give my $5 to help, I don't know. Nobody's even going to know if I did it. And in comparison to somebody else who might give 5,000 or who knows, maybe 500,000, there's no point in doing it. The other side of the unblessed and unbiblical approach is those who say, yeah, it's true, I could give an awful lot, but I'm just not going to do that because then I'm going to make everybody else dependent on me. Things are going to be terribly out of proportion. Those who should be giving won't give because they're going to think that I'm going to give it all, and so I'm just going to withhold my generosity for everyone's good. Two unbiblical and unblessed approaches. A friend of mine lives in East Texas and works for a philanthropic foundation. And he has organized a series of giving clubs that have 10 individuals or 10 couples in each of the clubs. To be part of the club, you must contribute $500 per year. No more is allowed, no less is allowed. That makes for a total of $5,000, and then the 10 agree together where that $5,000 will be given. He has also recruited anonymous wealthy donors to match it. So an outside contributor puts in another $5,000, or a total of $10,000. Now, that has all kinds of benefits and blessings. First of all, it means that those who contribute $500 are able to give away $10,000, probably more than they could otherwise ever possibly do. And the person who gives the $5,000 knows that it will be doubled and that it will be very, very carefully distributed. Now, I think it's a great idea. I think it's a clever idea. But it's not a new idea. It is exactly what the New Testament prescribes for the church. 2 Corinthians 8 says, our desire is that there might be equality. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, their plenty will supply what you need. Then there will be equality. So, hey, Jesus knew what he was talking about when he said, it's more blessed to give than to receive. We just all bless each other in the process. So when we give, we bless God, we bless the recipients, we bless one another. But there is a fourth and last difference that we make, and it has been intentionally saved until the last, because I think that too many of us might put it first on the list, and it is tremendously subject to misunderstanding. But it's true that when we give, we bless ourselves. The reason it's misunderstood is that some people think that they are playing the God market. And the God market works like this. You give away $10,000 and God will provide $20,000, 100% return. I mean, really, where else can you get that? And so just invest by giving it away, and God, who has unlimited resources, will provide whatever you need and then double it. Please never take that approach. For while there are some spots in the Bible that may seem to hint such things on a superficial reading, the reality is that such an approach is rooted in selfishness, is rooted in greed, rather than in giving and in generosity. Now, all that said, let's look at 2 Corinthians 9, verses 6 through 11. Which says, remember this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows generously will also reap generously. Each man should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. And then he has a quote. He has scattered abroad his gifts to the poor, his righteousness endures forever. Now, he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will also supply and increase your store of seed and will enlarge the harvest of your righteousness. And then summed up, you will be made rich in every way so that you can be generous on every occasion. And through us, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. Now, all of this is saying that Christians who give learn that the blessings that they receive back to themselves are wonderful. My short list has four. Number one is that when we give, it transforms our whole attitude and management of all else that we have. It is a revolutionary phenomenon. So that means then that what we give changes how we deal with everything else that we don't give in a positive way. It is a marvelous and astounding phenomenon. Number two is that God loves generosity. Now, he's not giving here a guaranteed return like a bond, but he is saying that he loves generosity, and for those who are generous, he commits himself to seek to provide the resources for greater generosity. That, too, is marvelous. Number three is that there is an enormous personal sense of satisfaction in giving. And it's something that I think has to be experienced to understand. It is a powerful blessing in that it makes a person happy to give. And fourth, that giving is what might be called a key spiritual indicator. Certainly not the only one. But it is to say that one of the vital signs of a person's relationship to God and spirituality is that person's generosity. I'm not sure that I have ever known or ever seen, I'm not sure I've ever even heard of, someone who was a committed and growing Christian who was not also a giver. The reality is that our spiritual temperature is taken, at least in part, by our generosity. Yesterday I was going through a large pile of mail and I came across a letter from a longtime friend. And with the letter, he had a photocopy of lessons that were learned in life at different ages. Now, since he's nowhere near the top age, he must have borrowed some of these lessons from others. But I thought you might be interested in just a few of them, not the entire two pages. Age 7, I've learned that you can't hide a piece of broccoli in a glass of milk. Age 13, I've learned that just when I get my room the way I like it, Mom makes me clean it up. Age 29, I've learned that wherever I go, the world's worst drivers followed me there. Age 53, I've learned that regardless of your relationship to your parents, you miss them terribly after they die. Age 92, I've learned that I still have a lot to learn. Now, one of the lessons goes like this. I've learned that you shouldn't go through life with a catcher's mitt on both hands. You need to be able to throw something back. What age do you think is the right age for learning that lesson? I think it's any age. I think it's today's age. Don't go through life with two catcher's mitts. Or as Jesus said it, it's more blessed to give than it is to receive.